Hello, welcome to USCOGANS, the International Law Podcast and Blog. My name is Leah Alhouzi, and today we are joined by Professor Robin Churchill to discuss the new publication of The Law of the Sea, fourth edition, authored by Robin Churchill, Vaughn Lau, and Amy Sanders. We will also be joined by my colleague, Cheyenne. By way of introduction, Robin Churchill began his academic career in 1970 at the British Institute of International and Comparative Law in London. In 1977, he joined the staff of the law department of what was then known as the University of Wales Institute of Science and Technology, and which later became Cardiff University, eventually becoming Professor of International Law. In 2006, he was appointed Professor of International Law at the University of Dundee in Scotland. Since his retirement in 2016, he has continued as an emeritus professor at the university. He has also held visiting positions at the University of Tromsø in Norway, University of Wollongong in Australia, and the European University Institute in Florence, Italy. He has researched and written on the international law of the sea for many years and is the author of 4 books and over 100 journal articles and book chapters on the subject, including The Law of the Sea. For the past 20 years, he has contributed an annual survey on dispute settlement in the law of the sea to the International Journal of Marine and Coastal Law. His other research interests include international human rights law and international environmental law, on both of which he has published widely. He has advised also on law of the sea questions for a number of governments, the European Parliament, and various environmental and fisher NGOs, as well as having provided written evidence to a number of parliamentary committees in the UK. So thank you for being here and joining us, Professor Churchill. To get the discussion going, we'd really like to gauge your interest and kind of know if you can give us an overview of the international law framework applicable in the area of the law of the sea, and how might the UNCLOS guide us in navigating this tricky parameters.
Sure, thank you. Well, thank you very much for inviting me to take part in this podcast. It's a real pleasure to do so. The law of the sea, as the name suggests, is the branch of international law which regulates activities at sea. Having said that, there are also many other branches of international law which apply at sea as well. So one shouldn't think that everything that happens at sea comes within the rubric of the law of the sea. International economic law, international environment law, international human rights, and so on, also apply at sea. And one shouldn't try to put the sort of things that they regulate all into the law of the sea basket. As a branch of international law, I think the international law of the sea is a little bit unusual in having a framework convention, which is often described as the Constitution for the Oceans, namely the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. And although that's supplemented by a large number of other treaties from specialist organizations and regional agreements and so on, the UN Convention does provide the overarching framework within which everything else fits. So in that respect, I think it's a little bit unusual in terms of branches of international law. I suppose you could say maybe the international trade law is rather similar with the WTO agreement and the agreements under the WTO.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you so much for the introduction, Professor Churchill. I was very curious to know how the project came about. We're on the fourth edition, but I wanted to sort of go deeper into how the first edition came about and what were your motivations behind that?
Sure. Well, the UN Conference on the Law of the Sea ended in 1982. And it obviously really cried out for a book to talk about it. There'd been a lot of journal articles written while the conference which produced the convention was ongoing. Obviously, of course, they date over time. And I can tell you precisely how the Law of the Sea began, because Vaughn Lau and I were driving along in his ancient Citroën to a conference one day, And we sort of said to each other, how about writing a book on the law of the sea now that the third UN conference is over? And as they say, the rest is history. But you know, we started out and the first edition was published in 1983. So we'd finished writing it within less than a year of the end of the conference. So it was one of the first, if not the first, book that purported to try and explain the whole of the convention in a reasonably manageable compass. And then as time progressed, further editions came along. And the third edition was published in 1999. And now here we are 23 years later. And you may be wondering, what took you so long? And we have been working on it for a long time. I guess it's a combination of kind of professional commitments, well-known particulars, a very busy practitioner, and have been an academic, very busy academic as well. And I've been pretty busy until I retired in 2016. And one of the joys of retirement is you have more time on your hands. And you can decide more for yourself how you spend it. So I think that perhaps explains why it's all come along really in the last few years. But it has meant that with a gap of over 20 years between two editions, there's been a huge amount of ground to cover. When the third edition was published in 1999, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea had only been in force for 5 years. And the institutions that it establishes three important institutions: the International Seabed Authority, the International Tribunal for the Northern Sea, and the Commission on the Limits of the Continental Shelf. Those institutions had hardly begun to function by the time we published the third edition. So we had to take account of virtually everything they've done and very much more besides. So there's been a huge volume of case law, I should think, at least somewhere in the order of 50 cases to cover, which by international law standards is quite a lot. I know it's not a lot compared with some human rights courts and WTO dispute settlement body, but a more general branch of international law, it's quite a lot of cases. And there have been at least 50 plus important global or regional treaties to cover as well. Plus a huge amount of literature. That's one of the problems, I guess, for anyone who studies international law, is the literature just keeps on coming, even if you're only trying to follow it in one language, and really one should be trying to follow it in many languages if one could.
Absolutely. So
I'm afraid, you know, a lot of it escapes one's notice inevitably.
I was just going to ask as well, like, since the last edition of the book was published in 1999, there's been some developments, obviously, to the area of the law of the sea. What I understand, it's virtually impossible to cover all of these in depth in like one episode. Would you give us an overview, or can you elaborate on what are some of the main developments that you've seen in this area?
Sure. I think one obvious area is the international seabed area, or the area as it's known for short. This is the seabed beyond the limits of national jurisdiction, in other words, beyond the continental shelf. And it's been known for many years that it contains minerals lying on the seabed called manganese nodules. And then in more recent times, other kinds of mineral resources from the deep seabed have been discovered, including sulfides around things called hydrothermal vents. These are basically holes in the sea floor where very hot water containing molten metals shoots up from time to time, and then those metals are deposited around them when the water cools. And there are also other metals on there called crusts, ferromanganese crusts. These have been known about a long time. And as you said in your introduction, I've been around a long time as well. When I first started studying the law of the sea, people said, oh, these are going to be exploited at the end of the 1970s. And then it became the 1980s and the 1990s and so on. And here we are in 2022 and commercial production has not yet started. But it is likely, and I really do mean this now, it is likely to start within the next couple of years. There's now been so much research and development that some firms are in a position now to move to commercial exploitation. So one important development has been the work of the International Seabed Authority, which was set up by the convention essentially to manage and regulate the mineral resources of the deep seabed. It's produced a set of regulations that govern exploration. So searching for minerals, taking up small quantities to analyze their properties and try to discover how they could be retrieved and processed on a commercial scale. But it hasn't yet produced a set of regulations to govern exploitation. It produced a draft set of exploitation regulations 2 or 3 years ago. And then last July, Nauru, which you might not think is a major ocean player, because its population I think is only about 10,000, but it has a ocean minerals company, which is in fact a wholly owned subsidiary of the Canadian Minerals Company. But they invoked a provision of the convention which requires the International Seabed Authority either to produce exploitation regulations within 2 years, in other words, by July next year, or to authorize this company to go ahead and start commercial mining. So I think we are going to see commercial mining starting, or at least at the beginnings of it, next year in some form or another. And this is raising big environmental issues because no one yet really knows how one can exploit these minerals without causing a great deal of environmental damage. Because obviously dredging them up from the sea floor disturbs the living communities around those areas. And then as they're dredged up, large plumes of dust and debris from the seabed are released. And the effects of that on living resources in the waters above the seabed is also unknown. So there's a very big environmental question mark about this. And indeed, some bodies, including the European Parliament in the EU, have actually called for a moratorium until we know more about it. But I think it looks as though exploitation will go ahead in some form next year. So I'd certainly mark that out as one big development.
This is quite helpful. And I think the speed with which the equipment are being made at the moment is just sort of indicative of the fact that, you know, there is sort of a readiness, at least on part of some actors, to just mine the area. But circling to the forward, one of the general editors highlights a very interesting quote by you and your co-authors. And I quote from the forward, the passage that Professor Scobie cites. It's that the law of the sea appears now to be entering a new post-UN Convention on the Law of the Sea phase, in which the detailed and delicate balance between coastal state controls and the interest of flag states in preserving traditional freedom of the seas is being overwritten by new principles and rules addressing the preoccupations of the states that see themselves as having major roles and at least some responsibilities in securing a satisfactory system of governance for the oceans. Could you elaborate a little more on this and sort of what you intended as you wrote this?
Yes, I'm not sure we used those exact words, but I think what Professor Scobie is getting at is that the traditionally has been a sort of hard cutoff between coastal state rights and navigational rights of other states. Navigational rights have almost been posited on the fact that the flag state has a kind of monopoly of control and jurisdiction over its ships. And it's that that's being eroded, I think, in various ways. One might not think that the high seas was a place for much criminal activity, but one of the things that has become apparent over the last 20 years or so is there's a great deal of criminal activity takes place on ships at sea. Not just obvious things like drug trafficking and people trafficking, trade in illegal weapons, but also instances of modern slavery on some fishing vessels, where fishermen are kept at sea for months on end in very dangerous and difficult conditions. And there are other kind of criminal offences also that affect security too. And gradually the international community is, I think, chipping away at the exclusivity of flag state jurisdiction through a series of multilateral treaties which regulate or attempt to regulate some of these activities like illegal fishing, drug trafficking, people trafficking and so on. So that's one instance, I think. And the other instance perhaps of a new form of governance is that coastal states also are seeing their kind of unilateral abilities to regulate things being modified again, perhaps more by soft law, so that with fishing, for example, although coastal states have the exclusive right to regulate fisheries in their zones, there's a huge amount of soft law which is trying to persuade them to adopt more sustainable management practices. And one of the real issues in this to do with the sea and the law of the sea is the non-sustainable exploitation of fisheries. The FAO has reported for many years now that something like 30% of all fish stocks are overexploited. And in spite of lots of exhortations to states to be more sustainable, that 30% figure hasn't really shifted for at least 20 years.
Okay, interesting. We can't discount the fact that there's the effect of human activity on the marine environment is wide range, from overfishing to pollution, and oil spills, and release of invasive species. So what are the ways in which, and since you dedicated a large section of your textbook to this marine environment, what are the ways in which the law provides protection to the marine environment, and how has this protection evolved and developed over time?
That's a big subject, which we tackle probably in a couple of hundred pages of the book, so I'll try and answer it briefly in about 5 minutes. But historically, the law concentrated mainly on pollution and pollution from ships in particular. And there is a great body of law which regulates that, primarily coming from a specialist organization, the International Maritime Organization, which is the UN specialized agency dealing with shipping. And that has produced a lot of legislation dealing with pollution from ships and dumping of waste at sea. But roughly 80% of pollution comes from the land. And this is where it's most difficult to regulate it internationally, because the territorial dimension dominates here. And rather, this is being regulated more through regional treaties than a global treaty. There is no global treaty dealing in any meaningful way with land-based sources of marine pollution. The most effective things are regional treaties. But not all regions have a treaty which applies to them. and not all regions that have a treaty have a treaty that is very effective. So it's very sort of hit and miss. Other aspects in which the international community has tackled environmental issues is through trying to address the over-exploitation of fisheries that I mentioned, and the conservation of biodiversity, more particularly the Biodiversity Convention has quite a lot to say, or has done quite a lot to do with the sea, but most of it is non-legally binding, really exhortatory rather than anything that's legally binding. One important development which has going on, which I should mention, is that there is an ongoing intergovernmental conference which is dealing with conservation and sustainable use of biodiversity beyond the limits of national jurisdiction. This has been ongoing for a very long period of time. The matter was put on the UN agenda back in 2006, and for a long time it was dealt with by a committee where there was no real agreement as to what to do about this. And then there was something of a breakthrough in 2017 when enough countries decided that this really needed a new treaty. And so in that year, 2017, the General Assembly decided to hold an intergovernmental conference to produce a new agreement within the framework of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea on, sustainable conservation and sustainable use of marine biodiversity beyond national jurisdiction. It's a bit of a mouthful. And this conference, unfortunately, got rather hamstrung by the COVID pandemic, because it had met the three of its projected four sessions before the pandemic came about. And then the fourth session was postponed several times because of the pandemic. It took place in March, 2 months ago, last month, in fact. And no agreement was reached, but the people taking part thought sufficient progress had been made that it was worth having another session in August this year to try and finalise agreement. So we have to wait and see, and we have to wait and see what kind of agreement is produced. In particular, how far it affects the competencies of existing organisations. Because at the moment, existing organisations do not have a very good track record, to date at least, in conserving biodiversity beyond national jurisdiction. So it remains to be seen whether a new agreement will be able to do any better than the existing organisations. And the issue is also complicated by a further factor, which is the question of access to and use of something called marine genetic resources. These are living resources in creatures, often ones which have not been known to science for more than 20 or 30 years, some of which appear to have extremely promising medicinal and chemical properties. And there's a question about who should benefit from that. And in particular, the problem is the old age problem that the developed countries have the technology to do it, but the developing countries rightly think that they should have a share of any benefits that result from this. So the issue of benefit sharing is all bound up with the issue of conserving biodiversity. In effect, there's in my view, two somewhat separate issues being put into the same basket. And that really makes it harder, I think, to come up with a solution which will be satisfactory for most participants.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's actually a very comprehensive answer, and I think did a great job on that. Since the third edition as well, there's been a number of technological advancements, be it in the form of unmanned and autonomous weapons or technology relating to the mining of the seabed, just to name a few examples. To what extent does the book cover the interplay of the rules adopted in 1982 and how they intersect with these developments?
We cover some of them. Some of the things that have happened, in fact, fit reasonably well within the convention. One important development has been the emplacement of wind turbines in the sea. In the part of the world where I live in the UK, the North Sea now has numerous wind farms in the sea. Some are as much as 50 miles offshore, producing now significant volumes of electricity. So this is a primary renewable source. It's not something that was known about, well, it was not something that was being done, should I say, at the time that the convention was produced, but it was certainly something which was envisaged as a possibility, along with generating energy from waves. And that still is, I think, in a fairly early stage of the development of the technology. There's been some technology developed which has generated electricity from waves, but not yet on a sufficient scale to be significant. But yes, other things are much more difficult. One thing that is now coming along is autonomous ships, ships which are not don't have a crew on them, but are simply controlled by remote control. I mean, a bit like driverless cars, if you like, but in the sea. And there's now a big discussion going on about, should they be treated in the same way as ships? Do we need a special regime for them? The International Maritime Organization, which I mentioned earlier, the UN Specialized Organization for Shipping, is currently engaged in a scoping exercise to see how its laws would apply or fit within autonomous ships, or whether new things need to be developed. And that may well influence the way that they're treated under the Law of the Sea Convention. You know, should autonomous ships have the same kind of navigational rights as conventional ships? And that's an issue which I think is still open.
And this brings me nicely to my final question. It would have been, I think there are so many questions that I have in my mind, but just for the constraint of time, the one question that I thought would be really interesting to the audience to have your views on is the fact that the convention is now, has entered, in fact, its 40th years, and it's the 40th anniversary right now. And given the developments that have happened since 1982, do you think the convention is still fit for purpose, or do you think there are areas within which it lacks, and how sort of the book deals with these questions?
Yes, the short answer is I do still think it's fit for purpose. What the convention did essentially was to establish a kind of framework within which activities at sea could be regulated. And the basic framework that it establishes, which is essentially dividing the sea up into different zones and saying who can do what in which zone. That's worked well, I think, and is generally accepted. There haven't really been any serious challenges to that. And one has to compare the situation before the convention came into being, because before that, there was a proliferation of different claims by states, which were contested, some contested by other states. Some states, for example, claimed 200 miles to do one thing, and other states protested against that. And there was a rather chaotic situation. Now, the Law of the Sea Convention put an end to that. It's provided a framework It obviously is not a perfect vehicle. Like any treaty, time shows that it has flaws. Things change, things develop, new knowledge comes about. But one shouldn't imagine also, I think, that everything that needs to be governed at sea has to be done through the convention. I mentioned fisheries, for example. An awful lot of fisheries is regulated at the regional level through regional fisheries management organisations. The convention provides the framework for that, but the detailed regulations come from those organisations. Same with shipping, that I've mentioned several times now, the work of the International Maritime Organization. So I think my sort of short answer is to say that it's fit for purpose, but there are certainly things that need to be improved and are being improved all the time, partly through treaties being concluded elsewhere and organizations adopting measures elsewhere. The convention is also being developed through judicial interpretation. Only over the last 7 or 8 years have we had some really meaningful cases where significant provisions in the convention have been interpreted by international courts. So provisions that were ambiguous or unclear, like, for example, what is meant by an uninhabitable rock, and they are becoming clearer. I think also there's a temptation for some people to see that the convention ought to be doing things which, in my view, it's not really designed to do and shouldn't do. For example, the question you asked actually was discussed in a report of a parliamentary committee in the UK, in a report published just a few weeks ago. And one of the things that comes out there is some people calling it to deal with international or human rights violations at sea. To my mind, that doesn't make a lot of sense, because we do have international human rights treaties. Most of them apply in some shape or form at sea. The problem has been in the past that international human rights bodies, regional courts, and the UN treaty bodies have been rather reluctant to look beyond the land, but that's changing, and you now do get cases coming before European Court of Human Rights or the Human Rights Committee of the UN, where issues at sea are being dealt with and the human rights are being applied at sea, for example, to application of refugee law and the non-refoulement principle, for example. So I think it would be a mistake to try and fit that into the law of the sea convention. Another issue is that's frequently mentioned is climate change. And climate change is obviously having a huge impact on the sea. The water is warming, not just the land, but also seawater is warming. And this is tending to affect the habitats of many species only tolerate water within finite temperature margins, so they are tending to migrate to cooler waters. Many fish species, for example, are migrating gradually from the tropics towards cooler waters north and south. Another impact of climate change has been the fact that emissions of carbon dioxide mixed with seawater to produce a very weak acid, carbonic acid, and that affects all creatures that make their shells from calcium, like crabs or coral, which is calcium. They're finding it harder to make calcium because of the acidity of the seawater. And then finally, the sea level is rising, partly through thermal expansion of heat water. You know, as water heats up, the volume increases. but also the melting of ice on land. The Greenland ice shelf is melting at an alarming rate, and chunks of the Antarctic ice shelf are now starting to break off. All of these things give rise to increases in sea level, which affect the interface between land and sea, and particularly important habitats for the spawning and breeding grounds of many species like mangrove swamps, salt marshes, seagrass meadows, and so on. And people say, well, why doesn't the Law of the Sea Convention have more to say about that? And my answer to that is, well, we have, for better or worse, a well-established regime for dealing with climate change, which is the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change and its Conference of the Parties and the Kyoto Protocol, and then superseded by the Paris Agreement. And they really should be left to get on with it. And I think it's foolish to think that the Law of the Sea Convention might do a better job than, say, COP26 or COP27 of the Climate Change Convention.
Absolutely. And I think your answer sort of captures the breadth of the issues and the breadth of the substance that Law of the Sea has to offer, and also just, you know, the amount of regimes that one encounters when you study Law of the Sea. And I think the book really does a great job in capturing it in as concise of a way as possible. And I think I can say this for myself, and I'm sure Layal will agree that we had a lot of fun going through the book. And over to Layal to conclude the episode.
Thank you so much, Professor Churchill, for joining us. We'll make sure to invite you next time when the fifth edition comes out. 22 years. It was really a pleasure having you here.
Yes, thank you very much for inviting me to take part. I've enjoyed talking to you. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Okay, bye.